there are these really particular games that just kind of creep up on me, and I don't realize that they're as big of a deal as they are. Mm-hmm. And this was definitely one of them. Like, yes. As I'm playing through it, I'm like, this game's pretty cool. I like this. Yeah. And then when I start doing research about it, I'm like, oh, like, this is way bigger of a deal than I thought it was.
Yeah.
100%.
Hello and welcome to Retro Records, where we talk about games I've never played and the history of the gaming industry along the way. I'm Mike, and with me as always are Kelvin and Matt. We're going to be doing something a little different for this episode. Because episodes have been getting a little bit long, we're going to start splitting them in two just to see how it goes. So just a heads up, this episode is going to be just about the development of Dragon Warrior, and then next week we will put out the episode about our gameplay. And we're going to do that moving forward just to see how it works out. It's a little bit more bite-sized so that we don't have 2.5 hour, 3 hour episodes. And we'll just see how this goes. So that's what we're going to be doing today. Like I said, today we're going to be talking about Dragon Warrior, which in Japan, it was actually titled Dragon Quest. When it came here to North America, there was something already called Dragon Quest, so they had to change the name.
It was like a pen and paper RPG game similar I think it was actually like it was related to Dungeons and Dragons and that they used some of the same enemies and stuff, but it was like a watered down easy version of Dungeons
D&D
is gonna be pretty prevalent, I feel like, throughout this entire experience.
I mean, when you talk about RPGs, even though D&D isn't technically a video game in the sense that most are, it is an RPG 100%. So
absolutely. But yeah, so it was titled Dragon Quest in Japan, and it was released in Japan on May 27th, 1986. So several years before we got it here in North America. When they brought it over to North America, it released in August of 1989. So we got it 3.5 years later almost. And I found this little tidbit, which I think is cool. So when it was being released in North America, it was actually under the direction of Satoru Iwata, which for a while was actually the president and CEO of Nintendo. So, yeah, he was. Yeah, exactly. So he actually was in charge of bringing this game to North America.
Thank God.
Yeah.
And it makes so much sense, at least for me, my association with Satoru Iwata. He did a lot of great things for Nintendo.
Yeah, for sure.
One of them was definitely apparently almost like an urban legend about how with Pokemon, they had to like crunch real hard, I think, to get it done. They were stuck on like an issue or something, had a breakthrough. And he like programmed most of that game in like one night.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Dude, why is it that like I because there's another thing I'm going to bring up later in this episode of a time crunch like that. And it just blows me away that like some of the most important things in gaming that we've talked about so far is under like this ridiculous time crunch. And somehow these fucking people not only pull it off, but make it something ridiculous and iconic while they're fucking crunching. Yeah. It's insane to me.
Yeah, that's my association with that man. That and when the Wii U kind of flopped, Nintendo, which is, this is really funny to think about, Nintendo taking a hit, but
they've taken their fair share of hits.
Yeah, for sure. They took a hit, and instead of them laying people off, he took a pay cut.
That's fucking cool. That's awesome. I am excited. I don't know a whole lot about him. I just know him, you know, obviously because he was the CEO of Nintendo for a while.
Yeah,
I don't know a whole lot about him. This is the first mention of him that I've really seen other than the little bit that I did know about him. So I'm excited as we go to learn more about him specifically.
For sure. Yeah. He's definitely one of those, you know, Nintendo household names like Lord Shiggy, you know.
So Kelvin, do you have any good stuff about the development? I know that you texted us earlier and said you were super excited about this one. So
yeah. Oh man. I'm so excited about this one, man. I feel like I was already really excited about the game just playing it because I had never I had never experienced this game. Obviously, I'm kind of familiar with Dragon Quest. I've never really played any of the games myself, but I know a lot of people that do.
Right.
And have and still do. So, like, I had the idea, you know what I mean? Like, I already had the sensation of, like, okay, it's going to be RPG of some kind, I'm sure. And, wow, like, it it just really was.
I was just curious, Mike, had you heard of Dragon Quest before this? Did you have any sort of prior knowledge about this series before we started?
No. So the only time I ever heard of it was when I was creating the list of games that we were going to be talking about. I came across it in one of the lists I was reading, and I was like, I'm not sure if we should talk about this game. I don't know what this is. And then when I did a little bit of research and found out, like, it's pretty well known, I was like, okay, I'll put it on the list. And that is literally all I knew about this. And I remember when we said we were going to play it in our last episode, or maybe it was, maybe it wasn't even on the podcast, but I remember, Matt, you saying that when you think of NES RPGs, you think of this before you think of Final Fantasy. And that blew me away. And you're actually not the only person I've heard say that. So, there are people on threads that I've talked to who say the same thing. And that is mind blowing to me.
So that's the reason I brought this question up. And because I wanted to give my little piece was, it's funny. I've heard of Dragon Quest like that. I can visualize, you know, the artwork, the artist who's responsible, which I know Kelvin is excited to get into about.
Yeah.
The artwork is very iconic, like is very distinguishable. I'm very familiar with Dragon Quest. I also, like I told you, remember playing this game as a kid. And when I think of RPGs I played on the NES, this is probably the only one I think of. I, however, until we started playing, had no idea this was the same series. I thought Dragon Warrior was its own thing and had no idea it was just a name change from the original Dragon Quest. Because when I think of this, I think of the NES box art. Like, that's the first thing that comes to my mind when you say Dragon Warrior, and that looks nothing like what the Dragon Quest artwork is like. And so, yeah, it's crazy that I told you that blew your mind and everything, but then I had my own mind-blowing experience when I realized this is the same series. So
yeah,
that like really set me off, and like I was interested to get into this game because I was a little bit worried about playing an old school RPG on an NES. But when I learned that, I was like, okay, well, I have to play this game now. And I, like I said before we started recording, I didn't totally finish this game, but I 100% plan on going back to play, if not this version, another one of the remakes, because I'm sold. Like, I'm really into it now. But I had no idea either. So
without getting too much into the gameplay, like I sunk a lot of hours into this game, and I finally had to stop.
So, understandable.
I'm sold on it as well.
Yeah,
it's really cool. But I just thought I'd share that like, I was so hyped to record on this, and I had no idea that this was actually just Dragon Quest 1.
This is what I love doing this podcast for, personally, is just coming across titles like this, where like, even if you are semi-familiar with it, like you're not familiar with like just the moment in time. It's cool that we're getting to examine these moments in time through these works, through these games. And just like, I had no idea that this was what it is, essentially. I just was playing it and I was like, oh man, like, yeah, of course we're gonna be into this. Like, Mike and I have talked about being into RPGs just in general, right?
Yeah.
But just to like do this research on this development and just see what this is, like, okay.
Let's dig into it. What you got?
Right. So Dragon Warrior comes from this company called Enix in Japan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Enix, a lot of people, you know, modern gamers are probably familiar with them as part of Square Enix, right? At least when I was like a preteen and really in RPGs, when that happened, when it went from Squaresoft to Square Enix.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
I was not familiar with Enix at the time.
I'm the same way.
Right.
I was very familiar with Squaresoft, and when they merged with Enix, I was like, I don't care. I don't know what they do.
Yep. That's literally my reaction. I'm like, oh, it's not Squaresoft anymore. Okay, yeah. That's fine.
God, we were so dumb.
Why
were
you dumb? Like, I always think about that because I have Final Fantasy X and I have Kingdom Hearts 1 on PS2. Mm-hmm. My Kingdom Hearts 1, I believe, is like the collector's edition, and it's still Squaresoft. But my Final Fantasy X is Square Enix somehow, or vice versa, something like that. I don't know. Something stupid. But yeah, Enix starts off. They are actually not a gaming company at first. They actually, I believe, printed tabloids or something like that.
Weird.
That doesn't really work out. So founder dude is like, hey, I'm going to make a gaming company. But he himself does not know how to program. He's not an artist. Like, he's just a business guy. So he's just a dude with a lot of money who's like, hey.
He's like, video games seem cool.
Yeah, let's just make some games, you know? So he essentially puts Enix into more of like a gaming sphere. They start getting into publications because, again, like, they publish tabloids. So they have those kind of connections. And they put out ads for a contest. A contest to make a game.
Right? I always love hearing about the contests that they fucking put together in the 80s.
What else did we do? Did we talk about that was a contest?
It was Mega Man 2. It was Mega Man 2. Yeah, it was the bosses in Mega Man 2.
Yeah.
They're just crowdsourcing video games.
Yeah, basically.
In the late 80s. Like, that's crazy.
It's like Roblox before Roblox. Yeah. 100%. It's Roblox with extra steps. Yeah. But yeah, so they put out this contest. There was a prize pot for the contest. And it was like, yeah, you know, like, you're going to make the game. We're going to essentially like publish it or try to publish it, right? So there are a couple people who won. And one of those people was a man named Yuji Horii. And Yuji Horii is an author for Shonen Jump magazine, which any weeb who just listened to this, just like their ears were like, huh? Someone's ears ringing right now because I said it. All right. Shonen Jump is like, if you're not into anime and manga, like, Shonen Jump is like the standard. Okay. So Yuji Horii, he is a writer in Shonen Jump, okay? But he covers video games. Because in Japan, right, we're not experiencing the crash that we experience in the West, right? Video games are booming. Like, video games are hot. Like, people fucking want to play video games. So he's having a great time writing for Shonen Jump. But he also designs video games on the side, almost more as like a hobby. So he makes this like weird tennis game, which, you know, is one of the winners of the contest. And it's actually the first game released by Enix. It's called Love Match and Tennis. But again, he thought more at that point in his career, I'm more of an author, or not really an author, but like a writer. So that kind of inspires him, right? Like, he's getting some confidence. Like, he just won a contest. Like, that's awesome, right? So he goes on and he makes a couple more games. One of them is for the PC. It's called The Portopia Serial Murder Case. More of a murder mystery game. But what's relevant about it to the story is that it's a like a visual novel style game.
I would say it's akin to a game called King's Quest, which was popular on PC back in the day. It's one that I heard of. My parents had one also called Police Quest, which was essentially the same thing, but you were a police officer.
Oh, interesting.
These were very early, like, I don't want to call them point and click, because you actually did a lot of, like, typing rather
than... Yeah, it's more like text adventure.
Yeah, it's like text-based adventures.
I just think it's funny that it's that style of game. It's not really, like, text adventure, but just, like, you know, kind of just that vibe is popular again right now, at least I think. But anyways... puts out this game and it does really well, and he's really attuned to storytelling, right? He's very much about, you know, I'm want to tell a story through this experience, like very narrative driven kind of experiences that he wants to portray through video games, because, you know, he's a fan of text adventures. He's a fan of like some TTRPG, tabletop RPG kind of things, right? Like RPGs are a thing at this time, but they are, you know, more kind of like a board game. There was, at the time, some RPG video games, but the problem with them was, at least according to Hori, they weren't accessible. Like, they weren't easy to play. And if you didn't have that context of, like, Dungeons & Dragons, most of the time you're just not even going to get into it at all. You're not really going to give it the chance.
I had a little piece here that I found interesting about. One of the ones that was popular in is a game that I've actually heard of, was called Ultima.
Yeah.
That was a very popular. I think one of the problems that Hori ran into was these games at the time were on PCs. And PCs have, I don't know how many keys. I'm not going to count the keys on my keyboard right now. But the NES has two. Two buttons. Well, yeah. a direction pad and two buttons.
Yeah.
And so you had to dumb it down. I don't want to say dumb it down. You had to simplify it in a way that made it accessible on an NES controller.
Yeah.
Another thing that I read that I thought was interesting, and I have actually tried to go back and play Ultima because I've heard, you know, it's like one of the earliest RPGs and I wanted to see where it was, where it all began. And I would never play that game. This game I would definitely play again, because I think that's exactly what it does, is it makes the RPG genre accessible.
Yes.
It makes it a little bit easier. You don't need all this background information. Right. Ultima itself, the game even tells you that there's like a 35-page book that you should read before you play the game.
Jesus Christ.
It's like, so you can like understand what you're doing in the game, like the whole point of the game. You need a 35-page book to explain to you the backstory and to be able to continue.
My God, make sure you read this novel before you play the game.
Which, I mean, like 35 pages, it ain't that long, but still, it's like the even the thought of, imagine today, like telling gamers, like, oh, this new huge title came out, but hey, before you play it, you need to go read. You need to do some homework before you play this game. People would not play it. So I just thought that was interesting. Ultima was one of the ones that I think they took inspiration from, Hori did, but he did it better, in my opinion.
That's why I was like, I wouldn't fight the dumbing down. Because, I mean, that was, you know, exactly what he was going for. Like, he wanted it to be more accessible. He wanted it to be more narrative-driven. Yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was really interesting that he really took that inspiration from those games and that style of game, and really not only was like, okay, how do I make this a video game, but also was just like, how do we make it so it's not insufferable?
Yeah,
I don't know, I just got really creative with what he could do, and but it's still like not complicated, right? And I was actually reading an interview with him that came out. When did this interview come out? Oh, this came out in 2011. And even in that interview, he's like, you know, the interviewer is like asking him like, so, you know, you have kind of like a simple philosophy in terms of a lot, but especially to like the game design and stuff. Like, why do you keep it the same after all these years? You know, like a lot of advancements has obviously happened. You can pull off a lot more. And he's like, nah, man, like that's just that's just how it is. And like I think it's a really telling thing that his personality comes out, at least in my opinion, in terms of like how the game plays out and kind of what makes this appealing to people.
So is this game like the new, have you guys played any of the newer versions of this, of Dragon Quest?
Like the remakes or the sequels?
Like the sequels?
So I have not played them myself, but I have watched my little brother play a ton of Dragon Quest.
Are the, like, is, so they don't venture really off from this original formula?
Or... So they do. I mean, because let's, I'm just going to say it right now. This is basically like the birth of the JRPG. This is the first JRPG.
Yeah.
So of course, there's a lot more that comes after that they adopt and take from other JRPGs that become influential, Final Fantasy. but they still, like, the thing about Dragon Quest that's really cool is that they are able to venture out and experiment with what other RPG series its contemporaries are experimenting with at the time and make it a part of the series. But, like, at its core, the series is still just basically, like, turn-based. You get a party, you're on an adventure, you're gonna get a treasure, you're gonna save a princess.
I actually kind of love that.
Yeah.
Like, that makes me excited to play more of these, because I do feel like there have been some, like, RPGs in recent years that I couldn't really get into because it has ventured so far off of, you know, what I loved growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of excites me to play more of these that it kind of keeps that same formula.
Yeah. Yeah. Hori even said in this interview, they don't like trying to mess with the formula too much because Dragon Quest as a series in Japan is super popular. He's talking about it's a family thing now. The closest thing I can think of that we can compare it to here in the West, in my opinion, maybe it's just even in Northern America, is like Pokemon. How we treat Pokemon culturally, like where now there's like generations of Pokemon fans, right? There's generations of Dragon Quest fans in Japan.
Wow.
And it was so cool hearing him talk about this. This is 2011 he's talking about at this point. And he's already like, no, man, it's like too much of a, I can't mess with this too much. Like, people are gonna fucking kill me. Like, this is such a, you know, this is like a tradition now. People share this with their families. They share it with their kids' kids. Like,
cool.
It's really a cornerstone of their culture. And I'll get back to it. But anyways, Hori is thinking about, okay, I want to make an RPG game. We're gonna go for it, right? Has these ideas based off of Portopia, narrative-driven kind of thing. Figure out the systems and everything, the programming. Have a baseline idea. You know, some of the unseen aspects of game development, I feel like, become a thing in this game's development. And I think it's interesting just how it pays off. So his experience is making PC games. They decide to make this for the Famicom. In particular, it seemed, because of how popular it is and how Mario took off.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty interesting. I think that's really cool.
I think that's interesting, too, because you mentioned narrative-driven. And I didn't really realize it until I started looking into this, but I would need to look at a list of our games to confirm this 100%,
yeah, you know,
facts. But this is the first game I feel like that is very story driven. I mean,
yeah.
I think we all praised Ninja Gaiden particularly because of the cutscenes, how it fed you a story as you were playing the game.
Yeah.
But this is a whole nother level. Like, there is a story to this game. There's a story to Legend of Zelda, I'd say, but pretty basic. But this one just seems, it seems like the first game that we have played where the narrative of the game was at the forefront. It wasn't like a secondary thought.
Yeah.
And a lot of the NES games that were popular in North America, at least at this time, were all reflex-based platformers, puzzle games, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this one came in, and it's like, there are no reflexes in this game. You just press A and you make decisions. But
yeah.
It's very much you're following a story, and I think that's what kind of makes this stand out, for better or worse. I don't want to say for worse, but like, without spoiling too much, this game doesn't exactly take off in North America. So yeah. But I'll get to that. We'll obviously get to that later. But
yeah,
I just think that's kind of cool that this one is very narrative based. It's not about dodging enemies or timing your attacks or jumping mm-hmm. and shooting like Mega Man, something like that. It's, mm-hmm. It's something completely different, which I think is so, so cool.
I was reading that the intention was to tell story through dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is why, like, literally in the beginning of the game, he tells you to talk to everyone.
Yes.
Like, immediately, which obviously that becomes a very basic thing in all RPGs, is you have to talk mm-hmm. to people. And literally immediately, as soon as you start the game, they're like, make sure you talk to everyone. Because they're telling you story through the dialogue. They're telling you where you need to go through the dialogue. It is, like you said, it is very, very much story driven.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just really cool that that's, you know, really just kind of the starting concept for Hori and the team is like, yeah, we just want to provide that type of experience where, you know, it's immersive. I think it's just interesting, just the thought process of just, you know, because like TTRPGs are very, you know, that's the point. It's escapism. You're immersing yourself in a fantasy world that's your imagination and or, you know, a mix of your imagination with maybe someone has like a plot or something that you're following and you go through the scenarios and things like that. And I just think it's cool that he was just like, you know, instead of having the players needing all this schema and understanding the rules, like you have to get your player's handbook every time you do anything. Instead of all that, like, let's just let the computer do it. Yeah. Like, let's just build this out, you know?
It's funny you say that. Sorry, I hate to keep taking us off track, but
you're good.
Have either of you played Dungeons & Dragons before?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I've only played one campaign, and it was with some of my friends recently a couple years ago. And it's funny you talked about bringing out the handbook and all that and just letting me do it, because my approach to Dungeons and Dragons was let my dungeon master explain it to me. Yeah, so I was so bad. I'm like, I'm not a great Dungeons and Dragons player. I feel like I'm not creative enough, you know. And there were so many times where I'd be like, hey, am I allowed to do this? And he was just like, I don't know. You should try. I'm just like, no. I don't want that. I want to know.
That's how it goes, though.
It really is. That's how it should be played, and that's what makes it great. But
yeah,
that's, I think, why I appreciate video games more, because I just let the computer tell me if it's legal or not. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's gonna do the math. You don't have to sit there.
Yeah. I don't have to roll the dice. The dice are rolled for me.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Whatever happens, happens.
Yeah. Exactly. No, exactly. It's I don't know. I just love that. Just took that chance. Like, he really had that idea. It was just like, yeah, like, let's make this accessible. Like, let's not make it, because I do feel like that's even prominent today. Like, I feel like I've heard so many people like, oh, like, I tried Dungeons and Dragons with, like, after watching like Stranger Things or something, or Ready Player One or something like that, and they were like, yeah, but it's, you know, I saw that you had to like read this book and stuff, and I just wasn't into it. But I think something that was awesome personally for me getting into Dungeons and Dragons like a couple years ago with some friends was like reading through like the monster manual and stuff like that. And like, there's a lot of, if you've never read through, let me just say this right now. If you are a JRPG fan and you've never read through a Dungeons and Dragons monster manual, do yourself a favor and do it. You're going to have a blast. You're going to have such a good time.
Also, I'll bet that you see a bunch of stuff that you didn't know was Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes. And it's awesome. Because you're just like, wait a minute, like, did they really just like shamelessly? Like, in some cases, it's pretty, in this case, actually, it's pretty, it's pretty awesome. But once we get to the discussion of like the visuals and the artists and stuff like that, you know, we'll get there. But yeah, so they're making this game, right? And they're just kind of like, oh, snap. Like, okay, how are we going to like market this thing? Like, what do we do with that? How do we, like, they needed some pizzazz, I guess. And so that's when they kind of reached out. They used those big like media network connections, and they were able to get to be the artist. It's Akira Toriyama and the composer Koichi Sugiyama. Big deals, right? But right, like, they have this like creative back and forth, really goes off well. There was, I guess, a lot of like nerve, like anxiety on the team in terms of just like, you know, these people have never worked on video games before as far as we know, or they have like little experience. Like, hopefully we get bang for our buck here, right? Which is so, that's so funny.
That's so funny. Yeah, that it works out like it does.
Like when I read that, I was cracking up. Like, mm-hmm. wow, that's crazy. But yeah, basically they, you know, create it for the Famicom. They release it. I think here in Japan as well, it kind of like doesn't take off right away. Maybe I'm wrong, but
I do talk a little bit about that in the reception, but I'm not, just go ahead and spoil that now. It doesn't initially pop off, but what they do is Hori, because he writes for Shonen Jump, he actually puts out a couple stories in Shonen Jump about it's like a Dragon Quest manga essentially, and that helps send the game off, and it ends up selling a ton. But it wasn't until that, you know, that Shonen Jump kind of boost that helped them sell this game in Japan.
That's awesome.
Amazing. North America was a different story, but we'll get to that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's incredible.
If I'm not mistaken, did I read somewhere that it's basically like the same three people that have made every Dragon Quest game?
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, pretty much.
They're like, all involved.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Literally, they definitely adopt the whole, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can also tell that because, like I said, Dragon Quest to me is iconic and like the artwork and stuff. But like, if you showed me a Dragon Quest title, like a cover art, I couldn't tell you which Dragon Quest it's from.
No.
But I could 100% tell you that it is for sure Dragon Quest. So yes. Yeah, I think like Kelvin just said, it's like a if it ain't broke, don't fix it sort of scenario where they know they've got something good. They've got this legendary artist. This was Koichi Sugiyama's, I guess, first really endeavor into video game music, but he is now.
He like, did do one before this, before one. Dragon okay. Warrior. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. You would know better than I, but he is now like the fucking guy when it comes to this. So, and there's a whole bit that goes along with that, but we'll get into that in a little bit, I think. So.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think it is. It's kind of cool that it's just like these three guys and they're just cranking out these games.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait for us to talk about the visuals and.
Okay, yeah. So do you have anything else about specifically the development?
Not really, because you know, pretty much just that's just pretty much how it came along. Was just this guy who wrote for video games. Started making video games, was able to flex his connects in every way possible and pulled this off. And yeah. Like, holy shit.
That's awesome. Yeah. All right. So do you want to go ahead and move into reception and sales? I know we kind of already touched on
it. Sure. So we did just touch on Japan. Initially, it didn't sell great, but after a few months, Yuji Horii, who was writing for, he was writing several, he had written several manga stories for Shonen Jump. And so he introduced one. And that's kind of what made the game. And I had this in a tab somewhere, the name, the full title of it. And I guess I closed it, but it is Dragon Quest with a subtitle. And that's kind of what helped the sales pop off. In Japan, 1.5 million copies were sold, and 1 million of those were in the first 6 months. So it was like the game kind of was sort of like a sleeper release, and then suddenly it was just like everyone had to have this game. So I think that's very cool. After that, obviously, like we said, the rest is history. Dragon Quest is just like a major, major thing in Japan. It has never not been popular since this, so there's really nothing else to say about that. As far as North America, when this game was released, it was a pretty big flop.
Ouch.
Yeah. And as I read about it, it wasn't super surprising to me. I think the North American audience just, we had never played anything like this outside of like the, you know, if you were really into like the PC RPGs, you would have maybe been into something like this, but most of the audience in North America was playing things like Super Mario Brothers, you know, stuff like that. So it was a very different type of game. Also, this game released in 1989 in North America, whereas it released in 1986 in Japan. So they were already on like Dragon Quest III before this release in North America.
Right. Yeah, I was chatting with someone on social media and they were talking about, we were talking about Dragon Warrior, and he said that, so I guess here in the States, since they already obviously had several Dragon Warriors in Japan, mm-hmm. or Dragon Quests in Japan, I guess when the first Dragon Warrior came out, they kind of released the second and third pretty quickly. And he was saying that the games here in the United States to us feel like they develop a lot faster and they get a lot better very quickly. Mm-hmm. So I think it starts to catch on more as like the later games are released, because okay. it's released so quickly and it's such a jump in quality because yeah. they already have had several years in Japan.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I will say one of the things I was going to touch on is they do update the visuals for this game. I watched some Famicom footage. It's not awful. I don't think it's very bad. I think the overworld in the NES version looks a little bit better. The major difference is that the sprites in the Famicom version, there's only once. Well, it's one animated sprite, but he always faces forward. So no matter which direction you're walking, he's always facing forward, which is a little bit
what?
Yeah, if you didn't look up some footage, yeah, look up just look up like so funny. Famicom Dragon Quest.
Yeah, I already got some pulled up, dude. Why his arms swing back and forth as yeah. he walks too?
Yeah, and so that's another thing I wanted to touch on is like it's way more noticeable in the Famicom version because he's always facing forward, but it just looks like everyone is always all dancing together.
They do, yeah,
because
they do.
They're all like moving at exactly the exact same time, you know. So yeah, in the NES version, you have like a up, down, left, right view of your character, which is, it's kind of a big deal. It seems so silly, but like when you see the Famicom version versus the NES version,
it does look a little better. Silly. Yeah.
The overworld, is also a little bit more detailed, especially around the water lines, the beach lines, I think. It's stuff that isn't it's not super necessary, but it's that extra piece of polish. You know, mm-hmm. we always talk about that, like the difference between what is like a great game and just like a mediocre game. A lot of time is just that extra detail, that extra yeah. polish. And that's what this has. But it also has 3 years of, you know, not that they were developing this for 3 years, but, you know, they had
3 years to polish it up.
Yeah. yeah, and they yeah. and by now they have learned plenty of new tricks that work on the NES, right? They've had 3 more years to develop games for the NES, so when they finally port this to the NES, they have a lot more practice.
Yeah.
I do think overall this game looks really, really cool. I think I've definitely mentioned before where some of the games that are early in the NES lifespan, in my opinion, look like garbage. Where you can play a game that's late in the NES lifespan and it looks amazing and you can wonder how these two games are on the same console.
Yeah.
This is one where like it's still 1989, but I think this game looks really cool. Yeah. And I think they had a few clever little tricks that pull that off. The battle scenes in particular are cool, where especially when you're still on the overworld, where it's like you can still see where you are on the overworld, but it brings mm-hmm. a little mini screen that shows the enemy, and it has like a more detailed version of the environment that you're in and the enemy that you're fighting. I think that's very cool.
Yeah.
I moved into visuals a little bit there. I did want to just finish up on the reception because I didn't talk about what we did in North America. This game was a flop, big time in North America. Audiences weren't interested at all. And so what they actually decided to do was to give this game away if you subscribe to Nintendo Power.
Yeah. So again,
subscribing yeah. to Nintendo Power, you got this game for free. And they sent out mail advertisements or advertisements for it in the mail, not the gender mail advertisements. Had to clear that up. So a lot of people, you know, it's not a free game. Obviously you're subscribing to a magazine, but in a sense it's a buy a magazine, get a game for free. So
yeah,
people who would have played this game got their hands on this game.
I did, because I posted about this on Threads, like when I first started playing Dragon Quest, and there were several people who popped up and said, yeah, I got this game for free with Nintendo Power. And yeah. I was like, wait, what? And then they explained the whole thing where if you Very subscribe cool. to Nintendo Power, you get a free Dragon Warrior game. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, yeah. That's so insane. That like,
I think that's really cool. Yeah,
I think it's cool, too. But I think it also shows that they were just trying to get rid of these games.
Yeah. In my opinion, I think it worked out for the better because I feel like if you give a game away for free now as part of like a promotion like that, I don't know what to even compare this to other than the first thing that pops into my head are those weird Burger King games that they release for Xbox.
Yes. You know?
Which are sort yes. of like, they're funny because they're Burger King games and it's like a cult, like hilarious classic thing, but they're not good.
You know?
None of those Burger King games are good. No. But it's a good game and it succeeded in that it put this game into the hands of people who never would have even given it a chance. And at least a certain percentage of those players were like, oh, wow, this is actually really cool. And I never would have found out about this. So I think that is very cool.
I mean, look, we have several people in our Discord who have played this game. Like Puzzle says she loves this game. We've talked about it with her. Yeah. She's a big fan of this game. When I posted about it on Threads, I got a lot of people saying like that they loved this game as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like they loved playing it. Like it was one of their favorite RPGs. Again, like you said, Matt, like there were a couple people who said the same thing as you. When they think of NES RPGs, they think of Dragon Warrior.
Yeah.
So, I mean, definitely whatever they did worked.
It 100%, 100% worked. So, to tie that back into visuals, another cool thing I found, because, you know, I'm always bringing up the Nintendo Powers, the manuals, books, stuff like that. Not only did the Nintendo Power come with this game, but it came with what we would today call a collector's edition. It came with an explorer's handbook,
yes,
an adventure guide, and posters with maps and enemies and things like that. This was essentially like a collector's version of this game before they even had collector's versions, before they thought people would even collect this kind of thing. And I played this game as a kid, sure, but like as I was finding out about this, even I was like, well, damn, I want a collector's version of this game. Like, I want all these things. So it came with an adventure guide, which was basically a front and back card, like a postcard. I'm going to post this in Discord for you guys right now.
Okay.
And it tells you, essentially, in my opinion, everything you need to know to get through this game. It tells you what you get at each level, what your HP and MP will be.
Oh, shit.
It also tells you the direction that you should be going. Like, hey, around level 3 or so, you need to be heading out to Edric's cave and acquire the tablet. You'll also learn the heal spell. It tells you what your goal at that point should be, so which city you should be going to, which monsters you should fight, which items, which weapons and armor you should acquire along the way.
What spells you get at what level?
Yes. So it's not, I don't want to get too much into gameplay, but this game is sort of gated in the way that if you stray too far from the castle and you don't have the correct amount of stuff, you are just going to get your shit stomped in.
Yep.
So this is a very good way of like helping you through that and saying, hey, you're only level 4. You don't need to be heading to the swamp cave yet.
I'm just going to say that I'm going to have a bone to pick with this particular card when we get into talking about gameplay.
Okay. All right, cool. So I'm actually interested in what you have to say about that, because I know that you said you did a good amount of grinding and you mm-hmm. did not finish this game. I'm wondering what to you is a good amount of grinding, because, I don't know. We'll get into that.
Yeah, we'll get into it.
So the second thing I'm going to link here is what is the Explorer's Handbook. And in my opinion, this is just like a badass version of an instruction manual.
Yeah, I found this. I thought it was the manual. Before you got on, Kelvin and I were talking. I was like, dude, this manual is pretty badass.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, wait, this is something different. This is an explorer's handbook.
I did the exact same thing. And that's because in North America, if you got this game from Nintendo Power, you got this. So this was your instruction manual. And I completely agree. It has like the prices of all the weapons and armor. It has what they give you as far as like plus to your defense or your attack, things like that. It has a lot of cool artwork in it. This is what, like, when I saw this, I was like, holy shit, this is the greatest manual we've ever seen that we ever will see that will ever exist. But then I found the actual manual, which, don't get me wrong, is
it's not bad. It's not terrible.
We compare it to other NES manuals, this one's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not terrible.
It's not amazing. But yeah, this Explorer's Handbook is very cool. And it essentially gets you... Wait, is this the one? This takes you through the whole game.
Yeah.
This Explorer's Manual will take you through the entire game.
Yep.
Which is like... I mean, maybe they went a little bit far on that. I don't know if that's necessary. But at the same
time... Well, I mean, this is an early version of... Like, I mean, you could buy stuff like this for Pokemon. Like, yeah, it's an early strategy guide. That's what this is.
Funny you should say that, because I also found the Nintendo Power Strategy Guide.
What? There's a strategy guide for this game too?
Which is about the same number of pages, and it only gets you through... It gives you through, like... It gives you a few maps for, like, the Rock Mountain Cave, the Swamp Cave, and the Grave of Garenham. It also gives you a map for the Castle of the Dragon Lord. But it doesn't necessarily like tell you what to do. If you scroll to the last page, there's actually some key questions that are like, where are the three items mentioned in the tablet? And all it says is the items are hidden well underground. So it tells you the ancient instrument can
be found buried underground.
Exactly. Where is Princess Squalen? She's being held captive somewhere. East of Garenham, you know.
Which, so, if you talk to people, you already know that.
You already know. Yeah, exactly. So this strategy guide, in my opinion, is more of like a beginner's guide just to kind of get you on the right path.
Yeah.
So it's kind of confusing to me how they included the details of beating the entire game in the Explorer's Handbook, which came with the game, but this that came separate is actually less detailed.
Yeah, sucks.
But it does have very cool, like, you know, the little artwork that goes around with all the spells. Like the heal spell to me looks really cool, where he's just like, he's got a cut on his arm, he just points at it and it heals, you know.
It looks like in this strategy guide there's like a lot more story at the beginning of it.
Oh, yes. And they do have like
a lot more story.
There's like two full pages of story in the beginning.
Yeah.
Which is cool. And this is like a, I don't know if they really go, I mean, again, not to spoil too much. I didn't finish this game. I don't know how much of the story that you really find out by the end of the game. But this story piece and this strategy guide seems to be very much like the prequel of what happens before the game happens, which I think is cool.
Well, isn't the third game the prequel to the game, to this one? Or am I...
Haven't played it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought
I read that the third one is a prequel to this game.
Okay.
I could see that.
So maybe it goes more into detail about whatever this story is that's in this strategy guide.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think it's cool. It's a little bit weird that the strategy guide is somehow less detailed than the
Explorer's
Handbook that
came with the game. I'd be pissed if I bought this separately and it was worse than what I got with the game.
I mean, but looking back at it, because I haven't paid money and I'm just looking on the Internet Archive at it, I think it's very cool. Like, I think both of these are cool. This is the kind of stuff that I miss about that era of gaming.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, some people may argue like it sinks that you had to buy a strategy guide to figure a game out, but I sort of appreciated having like something to help me, maybe because I was a child and an idiot, but and yes, those things are exclusive to one another. It's just like, maybe because I wasn't like smart enough to like figure these things out on my own, I really appreciated having something like this that tells me what to do and also has all these cool little like extra pieces of context to go along with the adventure. I think that's the only thing I will say is, if you're looking at the strategy guide and you flip to page 26 of the guide, it shows pictures of the slime and the red slime, and they look disgusting. Because that is one of the like when you think Dragon Quest, you think of the slime. Slime is like,
it's iconic.
It's kind of cute too.
Yeah, and he's cute as fuck.
But yeah,
these little artistic renditions of the slime, awful. They're nightmare fuel. Absolutely.
That red one looks high as fuck.
He's they both do. Yeah. They both do. The green one literally looks like fucking Slimer or whatever.
From the Ghost. Yeah, he does.
100%. Yeah. Yep. So, other than that, as far as visuals, there's one big thing I did want to touch on, and the artist for this game, whose name is escaping me right now, Akira Toriyama. Yes, the legend himself. So I think there was one thing that I found about this game particularly interesting, and that is the character designs.
Yes.
This game for NES came out in 1989. There were other JRPGs that came out around this time. So one in particular was a game called Phantasy Star 2, which came out for Sega. And that was in 1990. So only a year later. It actually came out in Japan in 1989. I played Phantasy Star. I don't know how else to describe it other than forgettable.
Yeah.
Nothing about that game stands out to me. But when I look at the skeletons in this game, or I look at the slime, or I look at the wizards, or the little flying bat wizard things, or the ghosts with the witch hats on, everything is so iconic to me. Mm-hmm. Like, everything about the art of this game to me just really stands out. And that's what I think is really cool. The Drakis, that's what the little bats are called. I just love everything about the monster design in this. Not that there's anything groundbreaking about a skeleton, right? Mm-hmm. But when you look at the enemies in this game versus the enemies in other JRPGs that came out not only around the same time, but much later than this game, these are the ones that stand out. We all just said the slime is an icon. Like, every JRPG to this day has a slime monster, and it's because of this game. Yeah. And I just think that that's one thing visually that just really sets this game apart from everything else that came out around the time. And like I said, that mixed with the cool little battle scenes, every sprite, especially in the NES version, you can tell exactly what it is. There's no question about like, what's the hero? What's a villager? What's a wizard? What's the king? You know, everything looks like exactly what it's supposed to look like. And I think that is just... I think it has to have at least have something to do with the success of this game and the series.
Yeah.
Because it's visually, it's great. I mean, it's an NES game. There's no, you'd be hard pressed to find an NES game that someone might call beautiful, but at the same time, like this is as good as you can get, I think.
Yeah.
In my opinion, visually, this is as good as you can get. So I really appreciate that.
I just have to say, like, as a fan of Akira Toriyama's work, as a lifelong fan, I was so pleasantly surprised the first time I ran into a slime in this game. And it was just like, oh, man, like, that's so cool. Like, I don't know. There was just like a moment I had personally playing through it. Because again, I've known about these games, but like I've never played it myself. But just to see that they were able to capture his style, especially at the time, you know, it's just there's just like a goofy, to me, the best way I describe it is like there's like a goofy roundness to it. Like, Akira Toriyama is really good at this point in his artistic expression on making things like curve, but there's just something so cool and so like bubbly and just energetic about it.
Yeah
I agree, absolutely.
And we could go beyond this game. I mean, I'm just looking at his credits on the Dragon Quest wiki. There's a lot of stuff here I've never heard of, which is fair.
Yes,
I didn't live in Japan at the time, but Chrono Trigger is on this list, which I think is pretty obvious that, you know, that's one of his games. you mentioned Dragon Ball, which is, you're much more of an anime fan than I am, but Dragon Ball is one that not only I, but 90% of kids my or people my age, when we were kids, we watched Dragon Ball or Dragon Ball Z. And there is definitely something very distinct about the character design that just makes them so fucking cute or lovable. Yeah. Like, you know, like nobody hates Goku because the guy just looks so nice. Like he's so friendly, you know?
Exactly.
Gohan's a cute kid. Krillin is a cute, tiny adult. Like,
yeah,
you know, we're getting into Dragon Ball. That's not even, we're not talking about Dragon Warrior anymore at this point.
But
the artist, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's just so, it's so good. He just definitely has a way.
Yeah.
And I think that's, he's 33% of what makes this game amazing. So,
yeah. Yeah. To go back to like the visuals of the enemies and stuff, mm-hmm. like there is something very clever that they do to differentiate like different levels of the same enemy.
Yeah.
Like if you, I'm looking at the strategy guide here, and if you go to page 14, you can see it very clearly with like the different stone men. There's like the gold man, there's the golem, and then there's the stone man.
Right.
And if you look at their sprites, literally some of them are just flipped horizontal.
Yeah.
To where, like, rather than their left arm being out, their right arm is out.
That kind of
thing. For the golem, for instance, and the stone man, they shade them.
Yeah.
So that it differentiates them from the gold man. And, like, it's a very simple thing for them to do because essentially they're the same sprites. But just by doing that, even when you're in game, like playing, and you run across one of them, but it's different, you're like, oh, this is a different enemy.
Yeah.
And it's something very simple that they did to make you feel like there's a variety of enemies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting you pointed that out because I did notice the different colors, obviously. That's something that tons of RPGs do. They call it a palette swap where they essentially just swap the colors of the enemy. But I didn't even notice that they mirror some of them. Another thing that they do, and this might be on other characters, but like, the magicians, for example, the base magician doesn't have a staff. They just took the staff out of his hand. But the warlock and wizard do have staves. Staves. Anyway.
Plural staff. How many?
Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't even notice the swap of the mirroring of the sprite. I just
Think palette swap. And they shade them differently too. Yeah, like the gold man has almost no shading. The golem and the stone man actually have shading on them.
Yeah. So
very cool.
Yeah, definitely very cool. Very well done. It's just like another step above what is normally done in RPGs. And again, this is the first RPG we've played, and it's already, I feel like it might be setting the bar a little high for us.
Right.
I'm afraid of whatever the next RPG on the list is because
it's gonna be like tough. Because I mean, again, we haven't even gotten to the music, but like it's seriously so insane. You know, we joked about it earlier, like it's so funny that they were nervous about releasing this with like Akira Toriyama and, you know, everything else going on. And I don't know, so again, I've been a lifelong fan of Akira Toriyama's work. I remember seeing Dragon Quest for the first time, actually back when Pokemon was out. I would see like the adverts in Nintendo Power and stuff, right? And I just remember thinking like, wow, like that's a really familiar kind of look. Like I didn't realize it was Akira Toriyama who did the art. But just something about it was just so familiar. Like, you just kind of connected to it. I just think it's funny because, like, this, like, Dragon Ball is, what according to what I read, Dragon Ball was getting successful, right? But obviously, it's nowhere near what it is now, culturally. But I don't know. I just thought that was really... It's crazy to think about this one guy having so much influence in like different mediums and it just like all mashing together right here.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think it's incredible.
It is. It's also like, I never put two and two together on the artist because I never looked into anything like this. But if I just Google Dragon Quest and go to images and look at some of the characters, like Dragon Quest III main character, that's Gohan.
Yeah, you know, like, yeah, man.
Dragon Quest XI, S, Echoes, something, something, something. That's Trunks with blonde hair.
100%. Yeah.
Like, they're so visually the same, and yet I never put this together.
Yeah.
So, like, that is Bulma as a child. I don't.
Yeah, like, you see, like, Bulma. A lot of the creatures that are just like randomly in Dragon Ball and like the Dragon Ball world.
Yes.
Like a lot like of the little dragons and stuff. Yeah. Like yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's very distinct. It's very just, I don't know. And I just think it's so interesting because that is absent as fuck in terms of like the promotional materials.
Yes, it is. It is. So the last two things I found were the commercials. I will link them, but I will just say they're nothing good. The first one is the North American advertisement, and the second one I'll link is the one that came out in Japan. And the second one especially is like, I don't know what they were doing.
Do you see like the thumbnail with just like the pink? Like, what is this?
Yeah, and again, it's like the entire advertisement, you know, because this is a podcast and we have audio listeners, the advertisement is basically a man riding on a horse and then some games.
Dude, it's true. Literally, it's like he's running through the woods with a horse. He stops to talk to someone, then turns around and just starts running on his horse.
Yeah. Also, at no point in this game do you ever ride a horse. Which I didn't really connect until now. So it's a very strange, whatever. It's an advertisement, you know.
Maybe this
is why the game didn't take off in North America, because the commercial wasn't very great. But
that was phenomenal. Holy crap. Thank you for sure.
Well, obviously, we will post all this on our Twitter and our Discord and stuff later so you can watch it. But for audio listeners, you're not missing out much on these.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The Japanese commercial is jarring. It's a little
makes
weird.
No sense.
It almost reminds me of an advertisement for a Saw movie.
Yeah. That was so dark.
It's like there was so nothing jarring. About just that. Like, whoa, what is that sound? I don't like those chords. You know, it's very strange. And for you know a composer that makes such beautiful music, it's so weird that the audio for this commercial is a little off-putting.
Yeah,
that's a good segue into
music. So let's get into that.
If you guys want to move into
this
that.
This is honestly the thing, like I said, before we started recording, I was like, you know, I didn't focus a lot on the music. I knew Mike was going to look into it for me. He'll tell me all about it. But then just like four rabbit holes opened up and I was like, oh my God, this is so.
I'm ready for the rabbit holes.
Yeah.
Okay. So the music was composed by Koichi Sugiyama, which we've.
Sorry. His name is funny. His name makes me laugh.
Koichi Sugiyama. Yeah.
Sugiyama nuts. Got him. Okay, sorry. I had to do it. It's out of the way. I will not say it again. Music. I love music.
So the music was composed by him. We've brought him up a few times already because he is part of the triad of people that have kind of made Dragon Quest what it is today. So, obviously, he's best known for Dragon Quest, but he did a shit ton of stuff. Like, he has done everything. You were talking about the artist and how he kind of has done a whole bunch of different stuff in different mediums. Like,
yeah.
Koichi is the same exact way.
Yes.
So, in high school, right, he begins to write different musical works. After high school, he goes to the University of Tokyo and graduates in 1954. After that, he goes into reporting at Nippon Cultural Broadcasting, which is a broadcasting company in Japan. It's a big one. After that, he moves into Fuji TV, which we've all heard of the company Fuji. So he started there as a director in 1958. He left there in 1965 to do freelance directing. But then he started sort of concentrating on music around 1968. And this is where he really starts to shine. So from the late 60s to the early 80s, basically what he's doing is just composing music all the time. So he does musicals, he does commercials, he produces music for pop artists, he does music for animated movies, television shows. Like some of the bigger television shows that he does, yeah. I've not heard of these, but maybe some people who are very familiar with Japanese media will know what these are.
Look this up.
Yeah, so one of them is Science Ninja Team Gacha Man the Movie, The Sea Prince and the Fire Child, Cyborg 009.
What?
Yeah, so he did the music for that, which it sounds like you know what that is.
Yeah, dude. Oh my god.
Are you like, are, was that a big thing for you like growing up?
So it obviously wasn't the original Cyborg 009, but they had like I don't know if it was a reanimation or like a continuation of the series growing up that was on Toonami a lot, and that show was incredible. It was really good.
Cool.
Me, this Science Ninja Team looks very familiar to me for some reason.
Oh hell yeah!
And I don't know why. Is this like? It actually reminds me of what is a Speed Racer?
It does. As soon as I looked it up, I was like, it looks like Speed Racer. It does.
I've definitely seen this somewhere, but I don't know why. Probably because I had a strange anime phase. I had a very strange
So do you guys know what Ultraman is?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So he did the music for one of the movies, Return of Ultraman.
Hell yeah.
Which I didn't know what Ultraman was, but as soon as I looked it up, I was like, oh yep, I've totally seen this guy before.
Right?
So if you're not familiar with Ultraman, Google search it and you will be familiar with it. You'll know exactly. Like, I guarantee you've seen Ultraman before.
Who this is.
Yeah. One of the bigger things he did, he actually assisted on some of the Godzilla movies, composing music for Godzilla. He did two Godzilla movies, which I think is awesome. I'm big into movies. I love movies. I went to film school, all that stuff. So to see that this guy is like doing video games and also did film scores and stuff like that is so cool to me. It's so awesome. I actually really want to go back and watch some of these Godzilla movies just to hear his composition.
Do you think he worked with P. Diddy?
It's super cool. Maybe.
All right, that's the only bit of Godzilla music I know.
He also did some music for some Dragon Quest animes that came out. So he's literally done music for pretty much everything. But the way that he got into doing video game music specifically, so this is actually a really cool story. So Sugiyama, the first time he ever came in contact with anybody at Enix was that he wrote a fan letter regarding a PC game called Shogi, which I looked it up. It's like a board game similar to kind of chess.
Yeah.
Kind of similar to chess.
They play in Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, do they?
Oh, yeah. They play in a lot of stuff.
Is always beating Jet in Shogi.
Yep.
Okay. I'm not a big anime guy, so I don't know that.
Cowboy Bebop is one of the few animes that I really, really, really love. So,
yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. So, yeah, he's big into video games. Like, he immediately adopted the whole video game thing as soon as they came out. He loved playing video games, especially on PC. So he played this game Shogi on PC. And afterwards, I guess he loved it so much. So he wrote Enix just to say, hey, really love this game. And at this time, he's already huge. Like, everybody in Japan knows who he is because he's such a huge composer for, like I said, all of these things that are like massive.
Yeah.
So when Enix get this, they are so pumped that Sugiyama is like taking the time to write them that they're actually like, hey, you want to do some music for some video games maybe? And of course, he's being a lover of video games. He's all about it. He's like, yeah, let's fucking do it. So the first game that he starts off with Enix is a game called Wingman 2. That's the first music he ever writes for a video game. Directly after that, the same year, he starts writing the music for Dragon Quest. One of the things I thought was really cool about this, Sugiyama was one of the first video game composers to record with a live orchestra. So I was trying to dig into this to see what that means. And from what I can tell is that he basically recorded the music and then transposed it to 8-bit music.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell. Wow. but because he joined so late in the development of this game, he basically had a week to compose the entire soundtrack for the game. Again, we were talking about this earlier about how like these fucking people have like such a time crunch and still somehow pull out just ridiculous shit that becomes iconic.
Yeah.
But I guess it took 2 days to convert the sheet music to game audio files. So realistically, he only had 5 days to write all of this music. Damn. Because he had to take the 2 days to convert it to audio files.
That's wow.
Which is fucking nuts. Yeah.
That's crazy.
The big tune from this game is the Dragon Quest Overture, which is the music that you hear when you start the game up. This, from what I read, this music literally opens up every Dragon Quest to this day. Yeah. It's the music that's used in every Dragon Quest with some slight variations here and there.
Nice.
According to him, it took him 5 minutes to write, but what he likes to say is that it took him 54 years and 5 minutes to write because of his lifetime of musical experience.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
But this music is so iconic that they played it at the opening of the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics.
Yeah. Yep.
So, which is fucking ridiculous to me. Like to have video game music played before the Olympics.
Hey, listen, you're talking about his impact on Japanese culture. Akira Toriyama was also part of that presentation because I'm pretty sure Goku was a part of that presentation. So
really,
yeah, like wow. In terms of like Japanese like pop culture and what is relevant. And listen, man, Dragon Ball, like Pokemon is one thing, right? Okay.
Yeah.
As like a gaming franchise and show, things like that. But like Dragon Ball is one of those things where like I'm pretty sure at this point on planet Earth, there's very few places where you could see like Goku or like something Dragon Ball related. Anyone could see it and not at least have an idea of like what it is. Like I feel like you'd be very hard pressed to find someone who you could show a picture of like, oh, what is this? What do you associate with this? And they're not like anime or Goku or Dragon Ball. Like it's iconic.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's ridiculous.
Like, and it's crazy that like this is only part of what launches both of them to that status with their work to become like literal representations of modern day, like Japanese popular culture. Like that's insane.
Yeah, so there are eight melodies, eight different melodies in this game, and apparently like his approach to the way he wrote the music in this game, RPGs to this day are still using that same format. It's like the eight melodies in quotes is like a thing in RPG music now because of the way he wrote the music for this game. So apparently there are literally hundreds of RPGs that use this same format of the way that he writes, the way he wrote this music in this game.
Interesting.
So it's not just that the music itself is good, but the structure in the way that RPGs moving forward lay out their music also starts right here.
That's so crazy. Like, what?
Yeah.
What the actual fuck?
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Nuts. Wow. I didn't know about the whole eight melodies thing. Like, that's so... reading it, I'm like, dude, yeah, that is a thing. Oh, my God. That's crazy.
Yeah. So I have a... Let's see here. I have a website pulled up that kind of explains what that is. So basically what the eight melodies sort of thing is, it goes like this. So there's one, which is the overture, which is the opening of the game. There's a castle theme. There's a town theme. There's a field theme. There's a dungeon theme, battle, final battle, and then the march, which is the ending of the game. That is the eight melody thing that people built on even after Dragon Quest became a thing.
Yeah.
It's like they laid out their music in the same format as those eight melodies.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy.
I don't know. That just makes so much sense. When you think about like classic RPGs and you know, especially if the music is iconic or really good, like all of that is just like, yeah, man, like think of those themes in an RPG and you're like, okay, all right, the field theme in Pokemon, iconic.
Yeah.
Battle, final battle, especially final battle. Mm-hmm. Like, you just can't have a good JRPG without like a banging final battle theme.
I was gonna throw that in. I think the final battle theme of this game is probably my favorite track on the whole soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's the one that I was listening to it, because the loops for these songs are relatively short, around a minute or so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could listen to the Dragon Lord theme for like 30 minutes straight on the loop.
Yeah, basically what it is, it's like not saying that there's only eight melodies in a video game. It's just that there are specific themes that are the strongest, most memorable tunes in the game. So it's like you said, the battle, like the final battle theme. That's always something that's huge. That's always something that's like emphasized. Like everybody loves a boss battle music. Everybody. Yeah. Like that's the thing that's emphasized. So it's not saying that you can only have eight tracks throughout the entire game. It's just that for those specific eight things, those are the tracks that are really emphasized.
I think it's also another example would be the overworld theme of every RPG has to be a banger. Because mm-hmm. you can't just listen to the overworld theme for, I mean, RPGs these days could be, you know, upwards of 80 to 100 hours sometimes. And if mm-hmm. the overworld theme is a stinker, the game is a stinker because you're listening to it for a very long time. So, but I also loved almost all the songs in this game.
Yeah, I love that. I love the eight melodies thing. Like, wow.
Yeah, it's something I never knew about before, but now that I do, I'm going to look out for in the future.
Yeah.
Okay, I have this really great quote. This is from a website called RPGFan.com. So the quote in here is, "Nearly everyone followed Sugiyama's footsteps. No, not in style. Umatsu went for a decidedly less classical style, and other Japanese composers went for modern pop and rock. But the style isn't what I'm talking about here. I'm referring to the choices of how much music to make, how long it should be, where it should be placed in game, and what mood each theme should set. These may seem like no-brainers, but before Dragon Quest, there was no precedent. Sugiyama and the developers of the very first Dragon Quest put the standard in place, and everyone followed suit in a rather homogeneous way."
Yeah.
So I think that paragraph sums it up perfectly, what this like eight melody thing is talking about.
Yeah, I just think, I don't know, there's just so many songs that just like I love so much that are just so relevant in my head that I can just neatly place into
I can
these
literally
categories.
Think yeah I can literally think of a boss fight from Final Fantasy X right now.
Right.
Like that's a battle theme. Like it's always in my head. Always.
I sincerely, and I'll you can quote me on this from now until like the end of time probably. I highly doubt this is ever going to change. But I sincerely, as a person who lives in modern times, I sincerely believe that One Winged Angel by Nobuo Uematsu is not only one of the greatest modern compositions of all time, but I think it is the definitive best final boss music of all time. Like, it's so, like, okay, a friend of mine.
Fanboy
just recently,
propaganda.
Listen.
Bro, Matt, have you ever heard One Winged Angel?
I have heard One Winged Angel. And I'm not going to hate on it.
It's not propaganda. It's facts.
It's good. And I will say this. I am not going to act like I could right now name a better song. But everyone loves Final Fantasy VII. And I am a Final Fantasy VII denier. So I have to also deny the song. But no, you're right. The song is amazing. It is iconic. I don't want to say it is the greatest piece of video game music, but I also...
He didn't say it was the greatest piece of video game music. He said the greatest final battle.
Okay, that's true. I don't want to say that, but at the same time, I can't give you something else right now. So we'll just call it fact. We'll call it fact. That's fine. I secede. You're right. I just...
You heard it here first. Greatest final battle music of all time.
I love to hate on Final Fantasy VII whenever I get the chance.
I mean, I get it. Yeah. I totally get it. I get it.
But also, you fucking great game. Everyone should play it. If you have never played Final Fantasy VII, you need to play Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah. If we're talking about JRPGs this episode,
you got it. You got it. If we're talking about amazing soundtracks, especially Final Fantasy VII, that is actually one thing that I think Final Fantasy VII has over a lot of the other Final Fantasy games is the soundtrack. Yeah. That is one thing I will agree on is the soundtrack is... 100%. It's a banger for sure.
Banger.
Yeah. It's so good.
Oh
yeah.
But yeah, because again, it's important to state again, you know, this game, Dragon Warrior, you know, this is establishing JRPGs and it just in so many ways that I couldn't even imagine. And that's one of them for sure. Eight melody kind of like compositional for it's like it's like writing, you know, he's pulling his experience from composing music for you know, shows, animes and TV programs and things like that, because something for me personally, like as a fan of like anime and things like that, is the same thing. It's like this consistency, like they'll make these tracks and this anime series, you don't know how long it's going to be, but you'll hear these themes in these moments. And it's like 20, 30 years later and the theme hasn't changed, but it's still relevant to what's happening. Like it's still, you know,
I love that when they have a theme that's so recognizable that it's not the same song in later games, but there's that little like, that little melody in there that just ties it together. And you're like, ah, yes, this is a Zelda game. Or this this is Final Fantasy because they have that in there. I love that. So
Yeah. This is one of my favorite things about doing this podcast and doing the research for the games is because like I will after reading about this specifically, I will never look at video game, especially RPGs. Mm-hmm. I will never look at this music and RPGs the same again.
Yeah.
I'm interested to listen to kind of apply what we've learned here to future games as well. I think
it's so cool. Like the next time we play an RPG, we're gonna be listening out for that structure.
Yeah.
In that music. Right. And that's so cool to me. It's I don't even know how to explain it, but this is definitely one of my favorite things about doing the podcast. So awesome.
Yeah, it's just like this newer appreciation for something you already loved. That's something you already enjoyed. Like you get to re-examine it in a different way, which we don't get to do a lot of times. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's super cool.
I need to look something up real quick, but while I do that, what is you guys' favorite track? Because like I said, I love the Dragon Lord track. The final boss theme to me is just like it slaps. Did y'all have a favorite one from this?
Let me double check.
Honestly, like I just kind of enjoyed it all. I mean, it, like you said earlier, like the loops are pretty short, so some of that did get kind of like the battle theme, it's just like, all right. It's awesome. Yeah. It's very appropriate, but it's just like, okay. I really like the castle courtyard music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought that was really just, I don't know, just very I feel like if I say it's appropriate, it's like not enough. It's that's not emphasizing enough of what I'm trying to say, right. But that's like the only way I can say it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think my favorite, which is going to be a little, it's not epic like the final boss battle, that kind of thing. But I really, really love the town music.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we were talking about Pokemon, yes, and how even Pokemon has like specific themes for like battles, that kind of thing. This town music reminds me of walking around in different towns in Pokemon.
Yeah.
Like Pokemon was a very big deal to me when I was a kid, and just hearing this town music like takes me back to that. Mm-hmm. Like it just has that feel for me, and I love it. It's calming. It's just like chill. Yeah. And I love it.
You're
love
in a safe
it.
Place.
Yeah, I yeah. agree. It's the town music is, that's exactly, Kelvin, you hit it. It's like, oh, I'm safe. I don't have to worry about losing HP or, you know, running into a random enemy encounter.
Yeah.
Being wolf place again. Where yep. I can just like talk to people and
not lose my fucking my fucking gold because I lost a fucking battle.
Oh damn.
Like, that's what the town music represents.
Tell us
for
how
me.
You really feel about it.
Dude, when we get into gameplay, you are gonna, oh my god, bro.
Oh sheesh, the tone of this podcast has changed quickly. That's funny. Okay. I'm gonna link you guys to, so I listened to the soundtrack on YouTube afterwards. Shout out to this person, Nico's 8-bit stereo. I feel like I see this person on YouTube a lot when I'm listening to soundtracks. This link will take you, I believe, if I've done this correctly, but also I don't know how to use the internet. I'm just like a child. But I believe this will take you straight to the track that is called Epilogue. It starts at 12:54. I want you guys to listen to this and tell me if this 5-10 second song reminds you of anything in particular. I believe it's 6 seconds long.
Oh.
It should. I feel like it's either going to be super obvious or it's not obvious at all. To me, it was like,
what? Wow. Yeah. I kind of can't believe that.
Yeah. Mike, have you heard this?
It's not ringing any bell for me.
This is 100% the intro to The Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past. When I was listening and I heard that, I thought the playlist changed. Because
yeah, I didn't. I haven't played that, so I don't.
You've never played A Link to the Past?
No.
Dude, that's the point of the podcast.
I know, you're right. It's the point of the podcast, but like my heart hurts.
Wait, hold on. I'm listening to the Link to the Past intro real quick. Oh my god.
It is, right?
It okay, is.
So
it's literally
the same
thing. I was
listening to this before we started recording, you know, I was listening to the whole soundtrack, you know, just kind of getting the music in my head, getting in the feel, and this track came on, and as soon as it ended, my like I audibly out loud was in my kitchen. I was like, ba 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 ba. Like, there is no way that's not the same song. It's so crazy to me. But
yeah, I'm gonna put those back to back on the podcast so you guys can hear.
It has to be like the same. And I looked it up to see like, was this guy involved in any way, and he wasn't. But man, it's the exact same tune coming in. And
that's crazy.
Obviously, you know my, well, if you don't know my feelings by now about A Link to the Past, just my disappointment, Mike, there should say. Not disappointment in you. I don't want to say I'm disappointed in you. I'm disappointed that you have not played the amazing, perfect piece of artistry that is The Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past.
We're gonna get there eventually.
I'll be so happy when we get there. But I didn't notice that. When I was listening to the soundtrack, I was like, hold up. I know this song. I 100% know this song.
We've got 27 games before we get there, but we'll get 40, there.
4 weeks. Okay. We'll make it there. That's fine. That's plenty of time. But okay. Yeah, that's all I really had on the music. I really dig it. I dig the whole soundtrack. I think the Dragon Lord theme is really sick. Yeah, I loved everything about it.
Sweet. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I like it a lot too. Let's see. Koichi Sugiyama. A little bit about him as outside of video gaming. He was given the Order of the Rising Sun 4th class by the Japanese government in 2018 and was also named a person of cultural merit by them 2 years later. So he is very much recognized by the Japanese government as an important person.
Wow.
Yeah. And he died from septic shock at the age of 90 on September 30th, 2021. And after that, there was a television drama detailing his involvement with Dragon Quest that aired on Nippon TV on August 27, 2022, which, if you remember, he started his career at that broadcasting network, and they created a television show, a drama based around his life when he died. Yeah, I got speedruns, and then I guess we can wrap it up with the speedruns. That's kind of an anticlimactic ending. Speedruns.
We can include speedruns in the... Put speedruns at the beginning of the second
episode. Oh, yeah, I guess we could do that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll add that at the beginning of the gameplay episode then. Okay. So we will end it there then.
All right.
So that is our episode on Dragon Warrior and the development of the game. If you would like to get in contact with us, you can follow our Twitter page at Retro Records Pod. We also have a Discord that is much more fun. We have a lot more conversations in there. We're a lot more active on there. I will leave the link to that in the show description. So if you're interested in joining our Discord and having conversations with us over there, you can follow us. You can join the Discord over there. It's been a lot of fun. And like I said, like we've said throughout the podcast, any sort of visual thing that we have or commercials, you know, manuals, any of that kind of stuff, we also link in the Discord for easy access for anybody who wants to actually see that stuff. So come check us out over there. It's a lot of fun, and we would love to meet some new people and talk about video games. We talk about all kinds of stuff over there. So that is it for this episode. Stay tuned next week for part 2 of Dragon Warrior, where we're going to talk about our gameplay.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Gameplay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah,
it will be great. I think the tone of that podcast is going to be a little different because I do have some frustrations with the game.
It's actually hilarious that we're splitting this up because I feel like from everything we've talked about today, all of us really, really love this game. And I don't know about you, Kelvin. Mike, you've alluded to a little bit, and I'll just preview. There are definitely some frustrations with this game, and really weird how the tone is going to shift, I think.
Yes. I have respect for this game, and I enjoyed playing it, but my God, did I get frustrated with it. So we'll leave it at that for now and stay tuned for next week. One more thing. If you liked the episode, please consider subscribing so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you really want to help us out, please consider leaving a rating and review. It just goes a long way in helping us out. But that is all for now. I hope you all have a beautiful week and you get to play whatever game you want to play for as long as you want to play it. See ya.
See ya. Yeah.